Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. When a conference focusing on the pastoral care of sick and elderly people, which takes place in the Vatican this week, provides us with an opportunity to speak to the Prior General of the Hospitaller Order of St. John of God, Brother Donatus Falcon. The next in our series of programmes focusing on papal social encyclicals. This week, John the 23rd's Mater et Magistra. Remembering prisoners and their families this Sunday in Britain. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by stepping back in time to the Feast of All Saints and listen to Pope Benedict's words on that occasion.
The solemnity of All Saints calls us to deepen our communion with the great figures of the Church who radiate the splendor of God's kingdom of truth and love. May we strive to imitate their heroic virtues and follow their example along the path of perfection.
Pope Benedict's words on that occasion highlight how, in the early days of Christianity, the members of the Church were called saints. Indeed, he stressed how Christians are already saints, because baptism unites them to Jesus and to his Paschal mystery, although he did add that at the same time they must become so. Clearly, Pope Benedict insisted on this occasion that aspiration to holiness is not just a privileged condition reserved for a few elect, but every Christian's task, a theme reflected in a talk delivered in the Vatican on Thursday, 16th of November, by the title of The Testimony of Saints Dedicated to the Care of Sick Elderly People, by the Prior General of the Hospitaller Order of St. John of God, Brother Donatus Falcon. He spoke on the occasion of the 22nd International Conference sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Health Pastoral Care, focusing on the pastoral care of sick and elderly people. In an effort to find out more about Irishman Brother Falcon's talk, I went over to speak to him in his office at the headquarters of this five-century-old order. This is what he told me.
So who are these saints you're going to speak about, or you're going to speak more about their charism? Or, I mean, you have to identify who they are, you have to pick some.
I have to admit, when I was first asked, I was nervous, I was asked to give a talk at the conference, and I knew it was about the elderly in general, so I said sure. And then I inquired, well, what topic do you want me to speak about? When I was told, saints caring for the elderly, I said, oh my God, there's no saints, very few, that jumps out at you. You're going to have to speak to 700 people from around the world about saints, and I know very few. And that really scared me. I went all into a panic. So what am I going to talk about? And then I read a little article on Pope John Paul I when he was bishop, and he was talking to the Women's Congress back in 1963, and he said, you mustn't forget that not all saints are canonized, that they're not all in pictures or in statues, that anybody who loves God is a saint. And I know a lot of people who love God. So I went immediately to start to reflect, well, where would I start? And I started back in my own place in the west of Ireland in the 50s. And I saw a lot of people who cared for the elderly. Ireland at that time was an impoverished country. It's only recently that it has developed. Immigration was the order of the day. Our family was the only exception. My father and mother, who are now in heaven, their ambition was that none of us would have to go to England. England was the place that people around our area went. The generation of people going to America was my mother's and father's generation. My generation, England was, of course, it was very close, but it was very far, so that we wouldn't have to immigrate. And they worked very hard on a small farm to keep us all at home, seven of us, which they did, to their credit. It was hard work. There was never money around, but we always had enough to eat. They sent us to school, educators, clothed. We were as happy as if we had a castle. But around us, there were many people who weren't as well off as us, whose daddies were working in the mines in England, the coal mines, or on the trains, or they were building roads. And some were working in big farms in Leeds and these places, these big farms. They go over for seasonal work. There were a lot of elderly people. There was no social security in Ireland in those days. You know, there was very little. There was some, but it wasn't sufficient, really, for a person to survive. So there was a lot of elderly people who maybe had only one child and the rest had all gone away. And he or she would look after their elderly or sick parent. They sacrificed their own lives, postponed getting married or following a vocation into the religious life, to the brotherhood or the sisterhood or to the priesthood. I know many who looked after the parents until they died and postponed their own choice in life until they had fulfilled their filial obligation as they understood it. And I thought, that's brilliant when you think of it, how unselfish it is, how generous it is, how there's a rightness about it. There's a sadness, too, in the sense that the person has to wait until their 40s to decide to get married, for example. Or now, we say, in 40s, going into the religious life or the priesthood, we say, well, that's fine. You know, you have experienced life, and that's okay. And you're still many good years ahead to in the service of the Lord. But in those days, things were seen quite differently. People were seen old at 50. So now you're only getting into your stride at 60. So there were a lot of those people that we knew, and they're saints. There's no question about it. I know one of our own brothers whom I use as an example, Brother Sebastian, he was from Westmead, and he had put off following his vocation to religious life, and he was in his 40s. He wanted to join us when he was in his 20s, but his parents became ill and he had looked after them until they died. And he was in his 40s. He only lived with us for about 10 years. But a very exemplary brother and a great sensitivity for people who are suffering, probably from caring for his own parents.
But what about the canonized saints that looked after the sick elderly?
Canonized saints? There's a whole crowd of them. It's hard to know, to choose. But it's hard to identify, you know, the word elderly. Because centuries ago, people died young. So who is elderly? In Sierra Leone today, you're 35. If you're 40, you're elderly. If you're a survivor, 50, you're very old because of the nature of things. In many countries where there's violence and wars and disease, and this was the way in the time of St. John of God and that the people died young. But the elderly of those days, John of God looked after the elderly. St. Camillus de Lillis here in Rome looked after the elderly. Jeanne Jougan in France, she looked after the elderly. So there's a whole lot of people who are canonized and are models for us, lay and religious, who devote their life looking not exclusively the elderly. Jeanne Jougan would probably be an exception, at least the order she has founded. They look at pretty much the elderly. They do other things, but perhaps it's because they're famous. They do it so well, looking after elderly people. Three of our own brothers in England are in nursing homes, run by the Sisters of the Poor. A wonderful, warm hospital. They too take a vow of hospitality like ourselves because they're very close to us in spirit. We have a number of congregations who will be close to us in spirit. One of our own brothers, St. Benedictine in Italian, who restored the order in Spain, he founded an order of sisters at the Hospital Sisters of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. The spirit is the same as ourselves. They look after people. But the elderly people today and we would look after, a lot of them would be geriatric, psychogeriatric, people who are mentally ill. We would have nursing homes for people who are physically ill, but we are particularly orientated towards the mentally sick because of John of God's experience. And we're very few orders in the church. Male orders would probably, the only male order would be very much orientated looking after people who have mental health problems. So wherever we go in the world, and wherever you travel in the world, and I've traveled quite a bit, the people who are least cared for are the elderly. The elderly, if they survive, the mentally sick, people with disability, learning disability, physical disability, they are left behind. And, you know, like the Celtic tiger in Ireland and the Asian tiger in Korea, both countries that I have experienced were called tigers because of the sudden development which both have had and benefited from. But in that rush forward, there's people going to be left behind. You can't keep up. So who is left behind? The people who are sick, have disability, who are challenged in some way. There's nothing from there. Everybody's too busy making money, finding a way forward. And these people are left behind. And their carers, their families and people are struggling. And you ask for money, and say, we don't have money. We're building roads, we're building hospitals, we're so many things we need. And you never have enough. If you wait until you have enough, well, then nobody's ever going to do anything, because nobody ever has enough. And we know that from life experience in life. People go from big houses, big cars, and even jets. I saw today one of the sheikhs in Saudi Arabia, he's going to have a flying palace. He's going to buy one of these airplanes, the new ones, the buses. So, you know, what next? You know, so this is where Christ and religious orders and committed lay people and the church, we need to keep bringing these values back, keep reminding people, you know, okay, you need what you need, but don't forget other people have nothing, that are struggling. So as a sister and brother on the journey of life, you have an obligation to look back to your sister and brother in need and to lend a helping hand.
You were listening there to the Prior General of the Hospitaller Order of St. John of God, Brother Donatus Falcon, one of the speakers at the 22nd International Conference, sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Health Pastoral Care. At this same time, on the 20th of November, you can hear another of the speakers at that conference. His name is Professor Peter Crome, and he's the President of the British Geriatrics Society. Time now for the third installment in my series focusing on papal social encyclicals, a series which has as guest speaker Dominican Father Alejandro Crosthwaite, a professor at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, sometimes referred to as the Angelicum. This week, after taking a look for us at Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum and Pius XI's Quadragesimus Annus, Father Alejandro, our professor of Catholic social teaching, explores the meaning of the next encyclical in time on Christianity and social progress. We've got to 1961, and the Pope is John XXIII. You may have guessed the title of the encyclical. It's Mater et Magistra, meaning mother and teacher, I should add, of all nations. Stay tuned. In 1961, John XXIII published Mater et Magistra, which means literally mother and teacher, focusing on Christianity and social progress. What was the novelty of this encyclical?
In one sense, the big novelty of Mater Magistra, again, the world has changed by 1961. It's before Vatican II, but already the winds, we could say, of Vatican II are already blowing. And so the vision of John the 23rd to open the church to the world is seen already in this encyclical. So the big innovation is especially that for the first time, John the 23rd begins to talk about the global church, talks about the relationships between northern nations and southern nations, so the poor and the rich countries. So before, they would speak more about capital and the workers, so the industrialist and the worker. But now John the 23rd has more of a global vision. So he is seeing the need of wealthier countries to support developing nations. At this time is when we're having a lot of countries who were formerly colonies gaining their independence little by little. So there's this whole new relationship between countries. And this is seen by John the 23rd. So this encyclical begins to look at justice in a global way. And this is definitely one of the main contributions that he gives. In other aspects, still quite traditional, because as the title Mater et Magistra says, he sees the church as mother and teacher. And this is the function. And it's in one sense, it's still paternal way of looking at the relationships between, let's say, the church and also, in this case, the wealthier states with regards to the developing world. It's a call to solidarity. It's a call to help out the poor nations or the developing nations. So we still have a little bit of that tension there, if we see it from today's eyes. But it's precisely his idea of the common good that is no longer applied only to local nations or civic society, but now to the entire world. That there's a global common good that we're called to pursue, which means, as we understand, common good in the traditional definition means the good of each and every single individual that belongs in a society. So not just a majority or just a particular individual, but every single individual as part of a whole. This is now applied to nations. So it's not that we are just to be concerned about the well-being of our own nation, but now also of our neighboring nations, especially those in the developing world. And so this is a revolution. And so this encyclical is seen very positively, especially by the developing world. So this for them becomes a flag, let's say, to call upon wealthier nations and to start establishing more of a relationship. How can we help each other? So several movements begin to develop, especially Latin America, for example, with regards to the United States and trying to foster plans to help each other financially and so on. In Africa, the beginnings of that starts with the Commonwealth of Nations, for example, with the former British colonies. So those are some of the early movements that we begin to see. And of course, the UN is already established by that time. So also the United Nations brings a global vision of social problems that is not just a local thing, but it's a global issue that we need to look at.
This encyclical Mater et Magistra is linked to Pacem in Terris in a way, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Encyclical on correct. Peace. Because, of course, at that time, again, we had the issue about other answers being given to the problems, the social problems in the world. And at this time, we have already the communist bloc, and then we have the capitalist bloc, and we have the Cold War. And this is what is determining the relationship between nations and how that world order is being established. So John the 23rd sees this, basically some of the big social issues and problems of poverty and so on, that in one sense, the root is the war between the communist bloc and the capitalist bloc, that so much wealth is being spent on armament and not enough on food, so much expenses towards militarizing areas for private interests from the communist bloc as well as the capitalist bloc, that basic development is being forgotten. So these are big concerns. And so John the 23rd, also through Pacem in Terris, sees the need to call for peace and the need to not invest so much in armament, but actually invest in people and development. And development becomes the big word during this time.
So in a sense, Mater Magistra was the first modern encyclical. Would you say that?
I would say it's the beginning, because it is beginning to give a new global vision. Like I said, we already have him in Pius XII in his Christmas messages, where he, after the experience of the war, World War II, also begins to talk about the relationship between nations, that we are part of a world, a single world. So you see the beginnings of that already in Pius XII, the call to disarmament, the call to peace, and so on, because of the experience of the war. And of course, this becomes canonized, we could say, in John the 23rd's encyclicals. So in one sense, yeah, we begin a new development of Catholic social teaching, a new way of looking at the world, and especially looking at the world as one single world. And that's the innovation of John the 23rd.
You've been listening to the third in a series of programs focusing on papal social encyclicals, with a professor of Catholic social teaching at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome. He's Dominican Father Alejandro Crosthwaite. And in his next installment, on Tuesday, 20th of November, he'll be taking a look at Paul VI's Populorum Progressio, 40 years on. And finally, let's go over to Britain, where on Sunday, 18th of November, parish priests are asking the faithful to remember prisoners and their families and pray for them. The initiative is sponsored by a Catholic charity, the Prison Advice and Care Trust, which provides support and help to prisoners and their families. Its president is the head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, who has called on Catholics to express compassion towards some of the most marginalised and forgotten in society. Susie Hodges has been finding out more about their plight. The United Kingdom's prison population has soared to over 80,000, its highest ever recorded level. Experts say the system is stretched to breaking point, with chronic overcrowding and a sharp increase in prison suicide levels. And the problems prisoners face behind bars don't end when they are released back into society. Every day, hundreds of inmates walk out of prisons with no home, no job, and no one to support them. As a result, two-thirds of prisoners go on to commit more crimes.
So why has there been such a dramatic increase in the number of prisoners? And what are conditions really like inside the nation's jails? In an attempt to find an answer to those questions, Susie spoke to the director of the Prison Advice and Care Trust, Andy Keane Downs.
There are lots of reasons for the big increase in the prison population. One of them is that sentences, the judges and magistrates, have become tougher. We've also seen a greater use of what are called indeterminate sentences, which are sentences which effectively say you will stay in prison until we decide you're safe to be released. We've seen a massive increase in drugs, and drugs fuel such a massive proportion of crime, about 80% of crime, some people think. And there are some very real problems. I think we have become more punitive as a society. I think also we've seen a failure of mental health and other services in the community. Our prisons do have a lot of people in them who are mentally ill, who I believe, and many others believe, would be better cared for in therapeutic communities, in healthcare-based communities.
Another distressing reality is that two-thirds of all these prisoners reoffend within 2 years of release. Is that a figure that has remained more or less steady?
The reoffending rate, as it's called, has remained more or less steady. The government are pointing at some modest improvements in those figures, but they're pretty much steady.
Why is it so difficult for prisoners to go on the straight and narrow? What's preventing these reoffending figures from coming down?
There are a whole range of reasons why people don't carry on reoffending when they come out of prison. One is housing, one is family, one is employment. If they've got a drugs problem, that can make it almost impossible for them to cope on the outside. But if a prisoner comes out of prison with £50 in their pocket and no family to return to and nowhere to call home and no job, then of course the likelihood of them reoffending is extremely high. And shockingly, that is still the case for a great many prisoners leaving prison. Prison governors and the prisons in Britain do work very, very hard to provide what support they can to resettle prisoners, but the funding isn't there. The government doesn't provide anything like the level of funding or support for prisoners to resettle on release from prison.
Turning now to conditions inside, we talked about the record high number of prisoners crammed into these jails. What are conditions like for some of these inmates? Can you describe perhaps some of the most shocking or worrying conditions that you have seen?
The overcrowding of prisons is causing some really shocking problems. We're seeing Victorian jails with cells that were built to house a single prisoner, a solitary prisoner, being used for two men, or sometimes jails using prison cells for three people. We're seeing an increase again of the suicide rate amongst prisoners, particularly those prisoners when they're first received into prison. One of the things that shocks me most of all, though, perhaps, is that so many prisoners, particularly men in prison, find themselves locked up in their cells for 23 hours a day. And that can't be any way to treat a human being, and it can't be any way to help somebody rehabilitate. I think one of the most crushing things in prison is the sheer boredom of men lying on their bunks all day long, day after day. There really isn't anything like the level of support they need in terms of training and education and work inside prisons. And I think that's something that can really crush people's morale.
You talked about, in fact, the high rate of suicides. What kind of figures are we talking about here?
Well, we see a suicide rate of about 90 people per year in prisons, and that may not seem very particularly high when you look at the size of the population. But what you have to bear in mind is that is the tip of the iceberg. It's estimated that out of every suicide, there are at least two or possibly three attempted suicides where prison officers are regularly cutting men down who are trying to hang themselves from the bars of their cells or from any point that they can find to attach a rope to. Self-harm is also very prevalent, particularly in the women's prisons, women cutting themselves, hurting themselves in all sorts of ways. So the suicide rate is really it's really the tip of the iceberg. The level of self-harm and self-mutilation is very shocking, and it's almost become a sort of normal feature of life. It's not unusual to be in a prison and to hear that somebody's swallowed a razor blade or somebody's, you know, being cut down. It's really quite common.
And in this situation, how important is the figure of a chaplain?
Chaplains are vital, absolutely vital. I think particularly for Catholics, whether from England or from Ireland or from overseas, and of course we're seeing far more prisoners now coming from Africa and Eastern Europe. For them, the presence of a Catholic chaplain can make them feel that the church is there for them. You know, in their darkest hour, the church is still there, offering care and support and God's love, and it can make all the difference in the world. The chaplains save people's lives and they save people's spirits. One of the things that we do is work in a number of prisons on a prisoner's first night in custody, which is the most dangerous time. If they're going to hurt themselves, the most dangerous time is their first night, the shock of coming in. And the shock of losing their family or fearing the loss of their family is the thing that can tip many people over the edge. So we have a scheme where we simply talk to people and we listen to them. And we also look into whether their children are being properly cared for. You know, there are about 170,000 children each year in Britain who experience the imprisonment of a parent, but there's no formal support network. There's no statutory support network for them whatsoever. So that's another group of people who suffer a sentence, innocent people who suffer a sentence, who we need to care for and look after.
You obviously have dealt with prisoners or met prisoners and helped them and their families. Is there any one particular case or one particular anecdote, be it of the prisoner or the prisoner's family, that really, in your opinion, sums up the scale of the problem or their desperate plight?
Gosh, there are so many. One that comes to mind, which is quite recent, is of a woman I met who came to us after her son was sent to prison on remand for attacking his own father. He hurt his own father very badly. Her son was on crack cocaine, had trained as a teacher, had difficulties in his personal life and got into drugs. And on one occasion he attacked his father, who was an alcoholic. So there was a lot of problems within this family. He was sent away to prison. She then tried to find him but couldn't find him because the prison she thought he'd been sent to was full. He was then transferred to another prison and then on to another prison, and she couldn't track him down. And because there wasn't the kind of service that was needed there on his first night in custody, and because he didn't ring home, he thought his family would abandon him immediately. So he didn't ring home, and she spent a month trying to find him. Meanwhile, he was on what's called suicide watch in the prison. The officers were watching him 24/7 through his cell to make sure that he was not attempting to kill himself. When she did eventually manage to track him down to the prison, it took her 5 days to get through the telephone system, which was engaged permanently, until she found him. She was then able to tell him that she forgave him and that she loved him, and he was then taken off suicide watch. 3 months later, his case went to court, and it was dismissed, and he was released. Now, for me, that's one example of what we do to vulnerable people. It's also an example of what we do to families.
Well, thanks there go to Susie Hodges and to the director of the Catholic charity, the Prison Advice and Care Trust, his name Andy Keane Downs.
And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.